Good morning. Please be seated. Before we get to today's argument, we have the pleasurable task, well, not to suggest the argument in our exchange with you is not pleasurable, but I guess we have the more pleasurable task of a motion by Judge O'Malley, so I'll turn to her.
All right, well, I have the pleasure of moving the admission of my law clerk, Michael Chacon. I'm sure everybody's here for this occasion rather than for the argument itself. I am familiar with his credentials. He graduated from the University of Delaware with a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering, worked as a chemist for 4 years before going to George Washington University School of Law, where he graduated with multiple honors. He then had the pleasure of clerking for Leonard Stark on the District of Delaware, and we know he got a lot of patent experience there, and he's been clerking for me for the past year. I know that he possesses all the requisite qualifications. I know that in addition to his great past, and despite working for me, he's landed on his feet. He's going to work at a small law firm called Covington & Burling here in D.C. So with all of that, I move his admission. He is a member of the bar in good standing of the highest court of Delaware and New Jersey. And as I said, I have knowledge of his credentials and am satisfied that he possesses all the necessary qualifications to be a member of this court. I will be sorry to lose him here, but I look forward to you appearing before us. So I move his admission. Do you need to deliberate?
No. It's granted enthusiastically. So please be sworn in.
Raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that you will comport yourself as an attorney and counsel of this court, uprightly and according to the law, then you will support the Constitution of the United States of America?
I do.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you. This morning we hear case docket number 131129, Apple versus Samsung. Mr. Lee, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Phil Lee, and together with my partner, Warren Fletcher, we represent Apple. Almost 1 year ago, the jury returned a verdict finding that Samsung infringed 6 Apple patents and diluted Apple's trade dress by selling 26 different products. In deciding JMOL motions, the District Court has upheld each of the liability findings that are relevant here. Then, in addressing our request for permanent injunctive relief, the District Court expressly found that Samsung's sales of the infringing product have caused irreparable harm to Apple in the form of lost downstream sales and lost market share to its primary direct competitor. Despite those findings, the District Court concluded, and it said, I quote, as its first and most important reason for denying the injunction, that Apple had not proven a sufficient causal nexus between Samsung's infringement and Apple's irreparable harm. But respectfully, the District Court adopted a causal nexus standard that this Court has never implied in the permanent injunction context or in the preliminary injunction context in Apple I and Apple II. Rather than requiring Apple to show some connection between the sale of infringing products or the patented feature and Apple's irreparable harm, or even that the patented features were a driver of consumer demand, the District Court required Apple to prove that each of the patented features individually and separately was the driver of the purchasing decision.
So that goes to the so-called aggregate, which he termed the aggregate analysis of individual patents versus considering all the patent infringement together, right?
It does that in part, Your Honor, and I think it also goes to the test he applied to each, in analyzing each of the different patents and their relationship to irreparable harm. She used that as a standard.
Well, that's a little more apparent with her analysis of the utility patents, perhaps, than the design patents, right?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that it's that clear from the opinion. I think that for each of them, while she found irreparable harm, while she found that design and utility patents contributed to the consumer's buying decision, she found it to be an insufficient causal nexus. maybe I can answer the question this way and go directly to the point on causal nexus. We represented to the court that since eBay, no Federal Circuit decision or Supreme Court decision has required a causal nexus in the permanent injunction context. To ensure that we were correct, we've looked at all of the post-eBay decisions of this court. There have been about 44 that have substantively addressed the question of what's required for a permanent injunction after an adjudication of infringement.
Well, I take your point, and I think the briefs really articulate that. But let me ask you, assuming that there is a nexus requirement for a moment, which you happily assume in your briefs as an alternative, what do you think is a reasonable formulation of such a causal nexus?
Let me answer that in two ways, Your Honor. And first, if I take the assumption, which is there's some connection required, you can have the requirement of some connection, which I think is articulated in Apple One, to a driver of a consumer purchasing decision, to the sole driver of the purchasing decision. For sure, that latter standard, which I think the district court applied, is too rigid and would categorically deny injunctions to multifunction products. I think the answer most directly to Your Honor's question is this: for a permanent injunction request post-adjudication of infringement, and I would start it this way and say what it's not and then what it is. It is not. We are not contending that an adjudication of infringement leads like night follows a day to an injunction. That's precisely what was rejected in eBay. We are not contending that an adjudication of infringement leads like night follows a day to satisfaction of the first factor of eBay, irreparable harm. You could have a non-practicing entity that's proved infringement, adjudicated infringement, but doesn't have irreparable harm. We are saying this: when there has been an adjudication of an infringement, and under 271, the products that infringe are what's an issue that contain the features, then that adjudication of infringement, if the sale of those products causes irreparable harm, that's enough of a connection. So it is the adjudicated infringement of products that infringe that supply the connection. And we think that that's enough. Now, that's not to say that Judge Bryson's question about the cup holders is still not relevant. And I wasn't here for that argument, but I've read and thought about cup holders. Those cup holders, we submit, get addressed in factors 3 and 4, balancing the hardships and the public interest. And in fact, this court has done that twice. In the Broadcom case, there was a sunset phase-in period. It was a multifunction product. The two patents that were adjudicated to be infringed involved a walkie-talkie feature and simultaneous communication. But the products themselves, and this is a pre-Apple I and Apple II permanent injunction case, the products themselves allowed for baseband communications, graphics, video compression, a host of other functions. And what the court did is it said, there's indirect competition. There's the sale of this chip. This chip infringes. What we're going to do is enjoin the sale of this chip, but we're going to provide under factor 3, balancing the hardships, a period of time during which the feature can be phased out or redesigned. This court blessed that as a carefully crafted balancing of the respective interests of the parties. Now, what happens with that type of sunset provision, and there was one in I4I as well, this court changed from 3 months to 5 months. What happens is this: if the feature truly is unimportant, if the feature is not key to the purchasing decision, then it will be designed out at the end of 5 months or 2 years or however long the sunset period is. But if you get to the end of the sunset period, a period of time when technologically and practically you design it out, and it's still there, then that tells us in real-world terms that it is important to the sale of the product, and it should be enjoined at that point.
Let me turn to Judge O'Malley, though, because I cut her off before.
Yeah. Well, I actually was going a little bit to where you're going, and that is that you do argue that there should be no nexus requirement at the permanent injunction stage. And you know, the problem with that is, regardless of how you define it, I mean, even if you don't find those words used in all those cases, if you look at the facts in those cases, there seems to be a nexus, at least in the common tort sense. I mean, I can't imagine that you wouldn't have some nexus requirement, regardless of how you define it, in every case in which a permanent injunction was considered.
Yeah, Your Honor, that's why I tried to use the word a connection, because certainly if we had demonstrated loss of market share, and it was because we had 8 senior executives who'd been indicted for felonies in a variety of countries, and that's why our market share dropped, there would be no connection. But when there has been an adjudication that certain products infringe, and the sale of those products have caused irreparable harm, that's the connection, that should be enough. And let me answer your question, because I think the other cases this court has decided are important. If you look at Bosch and Presidio and Douglas, one decided before Apple I and Apple II, two decided after Apple II, all of them either affirming the entry of a permanent injunction or twice decisions vacating the denial and ordering the entry of a permanent injunction. In all three of them, the invention was just one small component of a multi-featured product. So in Douglas, the most recent, it was a latch on a snowplow assembly. But the claim was a snowplow assembly, and then the latch was one of the limitations. There was absolutely no proof that the latch drove demand for the snowplow or the snowplow assemblies. None at all. But this court vacated the denial and remanded for entry of an injunction. If there was a requirement of the causal nexus that was used by the district court here, that could never have occurred. The same is true in Presidio. It's a monolithic capacitor that's claimed. And the claim is what you'd expect. It claims a monolithic capacitor. But the key limitation is a fringed effect capacitance. And that opinion is particularly instructive for this reason. The court actually addressed the question of whether that limitation, fringe effect capacitance, drove consumer demand. And it did it in the context of lost profits and the Panduit factor and said, you don't have to prove that, and there's no evidence here. And then the court got to the permanent injunction issue and said a permanent injunction should have issued. If you compare the claims in those three cases to claims at issue here, all of the claims of the, for instance, utility patents claim the device with a feature being part of the device. The claims are an absolute parallel. And
so is it your position that we couldn't adopt a nexus requirement in this case, any kind of nexus requirement in this case, barring an en banc determination?
No, we're not saying that at all. I think that the preliminary injunction cases and the permanent injunction cases, while the standards overlap some, are different. The contexts are different. This court said so in Abbott.
Well, on that point, it was the one part of your argument I recognize the backup argument, because you think the causal nexus should not be present for either preliminary or permanent. But I found the distinction that you drew between preliminary and permanent with respect to the causal nexus requirement to be a little unclear. So why does it make a difference? I understand there are differences
right
between preliminary injunction and final permanent injunction,
Your Honor,
but why does that make a difference with respect to this particular requirement?
Your Honor, I would say for three reasons. And I think actually this court's decision in Abbott captures it. It talks about the fact that under Amoco, the standards for preliminary and permanent injunctions overlap substantially, and many of the words are the same and mean the same. But this court said, but in the preliminary injunction context, the manner in which you balance those factors is different. Why? And here are the three reasons. The first is the preliminary injunction context occurs before there's been an adjudication of infringement. You have to make a judgment as to whether there's a likelihood of success. Here, there's been an adjudication of infringement. Reason number two, as a consequence of reason number one, in the preliminary injunction context, you are changing the status quo. You're changing the status quo before anybody has had an opportunity to determine who whose rights are being infringed, if at all. In the permanent injunction context, all you're doing is entering an injunction to conform behavior to adjudicated rights. And the third thing, Your Honor, goes to the Broadcom I4I Factor 3 balancing injunctions that phase in, sunset, the cup holder. In the permanent injunction context, you can balance the considerations of the party. You can address the importance of the feature to the product by phase-ins, sunsets. Now, theoretically, I guess you could do that in a preliminary injunction context. It makes a lot less practical sense. The idea that you would phase in a change on a preliminary injunction basis doesn't make much sense. But what was done in Broadcom, what was done in I4I, demonstrates that the balance can be struck, I would suggest, pretty easily. You enter an injunction that says, stop selling the products that have the infringing feature. Stop selling the infringing feature. You will have X number of days to design it out.
How do you respond to your friend's argument on the other side that says that you waived that Broadcom I4I argument or waived any right to ask us to make that a part of our analysis?
Your Honor, I have two responses. One is, and you'll see in the footnote in our reply brief, we raised this issue at below and we've raised the issue here. There's been no waiver. The second thing is, at least as I understand the argument, the question of what type of injunction should be crafted to address a situation like this. I mean, Your Honor, this is a situation in which, and this is the proof we described in our brief, this is a situation in which Apple spent 5 years and $5 billion designing a product. It was a revolutionary product. It's hard for most of us to remember what a phone looked like in 2007, but it was revolutionary. This is a case in which Samsung looked at it immediately and said, this is easily copied, but we don't need to because it's going to be unsuccessful. And it's a case in which 2 years later, they had a summit and decided to copy it. And they spent three months, copied it and brought the product to market. And the result was what's on page 18 of our opening brief. You see what happened to the market share. That is a situation in which it's a classic case in which an injunction should issue.
Can I, just a quick question on damages,
sure. And then I do have, I think we want to turn briefly at least to the dilution issue.
Sure.
But on damages, this comes up with respect to the loss of downstream sales.
Right.
As part of the case in chief on damages, did Apple include evidence with regard to downstream sales and those losses? Was that part and parcel of your damages case?
No. The damages case was principally was based upon historical sales. So it was sales that had occurred, and I don't remember the precise date. It was to a date in 2012, but it was historical sales only. So the loss sales of the infringing products past that date were not included. The downstream sales, which I would include as other products, right, as part of the Apple system, okay. I buy an iPad, I also want an iPhone, I also want an iMac, was not included as damages. It was included as proof of our irreparable harm. And the lost market share was an issue because it went to questions like reasonable royalty. But there was not any request for compensation for the lost market share as lost market share.
I don't know, downstream sales, the trial court made a specific finding on that, right?
Yes.
That there was a loss of downstream sales.
There was a loss of downstream sales. I mean, the trial court found that we had demonstrated greater irreparable harm than we had at the preliminary injunction stage, that there were lost sales of the infringing products, which I think is the connection that I think is you have to have to for permanent injunction purposes. She found there was lost downstream sales. The only place she found the evidence equivocal on these issues is whether there were ecosystem issues. And she just said she wasn't making a determination on that. But she said, notwithstanding that, if you put it all together, there's irreparable harm.
I take it that, well, at least Samsung represents, and you tell me whether you agree with this, that I think 23 of the 26 adjudicated products with respect to the patents are not being sold anymore, at least Aonomy. And the other three have had design arounds in their view at least, avoid infringement. Do you agree with it? Perhaps you don't know with respect to the three, but do you agree with respect to the 23?
No, Your Honor, and here's the reason why. This is a place where we have to be very careful to consider what Samsung's business model is. Unlike Apple, which introduces one new phone a year or so.
I understand they introduce a lot of phones.
So if you look at the evidence they cite to you that says this product is off the market, what they're saying to you is the product with that name is off the market. There's another product on the market, and for a number of them, we say they still have infringing features.
Which is where we get to the not colorably different part of the injunction. But
right.
My question ultimately is this. Is what we're basically here about today all about the process that's going to be employed if you go after some of these renamed, let's call them, phones as being, suppose you get an injunction, and it's a not colorably different clause injunction. That process would then be in contempt proceeding if you wanted to have those phones adjudicated as within the scope of the injunction. That would require you, I take it, to prove that they actually do infringe, right?
Right.
Right, okay. So if are we here about whether that process is to take place in front of the trial court in a contempt proceeding as opposed to in a new adjudication of infringement, and is that really all that is at issue here? I mean, that may understate the importance of that distinction, but is that really what we're dealing with?
Your Honor, let me answer that in two ways.
Sorry.
One case specific and one a little bit more broadly, if I could. The district court specifically said at footnote 4, page 7 of its opinion, that it was offering no view on whether the design arounds had been effective design arounds or not. We contest whether design arounds are effective.
Okay. But then the question comes up, what's the context in which that contest is going to be played out?
Yeah, without a doubt, Your Honor, if we were to obtain an injunction, had it included the not colorably different, the context in which it will play out is in a contempt proceeding where we do have to prove infringement, but all the other issues are going to be different than commencing a new follow-on proceeding, a new district court proceeding, a new jury trial, right, on another set of products.
Well, let's assume that you prevail on appeal and that you are entitled to collateral estoppel on all the issues that were in dispute in the first action. There's not going to be a whole lot left, I don't suppose, is there?
I think the primary issue would be whether the new product infringes or not. And, you know, it is a distinction of some significance. In fact, in the Broadcom case, Your Honor, after this injunction was affirmed by this court, there were four contempt proceedings, that three of which went to decision, all of which were under the colorably different portion of the injunction. But I say, if I could, there is a broader issue here because of the rule that the district court has imposed. It is close to a categorical rule that for a multi-function product, you cannot get a permanent injunction. Could we prove that each of these three patents, three design patents, three utility patents, are the driver of the consumer purchasing decision? I'm not going to stand here and tell you that we could. I don't think we can. I don't think that anybody in Apple's circumstances could. That standard, which would categorically deny relief to a group of type of patents and type of product, we suggest has three problems. One, it would be inconsistent with eBay. It would be precisely the type of categorical rule that eBay discourages. Second, it really would call into question whether it was consistent with Section 154 and the statutory right to exclude. But third, and most importantly, it would work a fundamental change in American intellectual property law. And again, the best indication I can give this court is that this panel considers all of the post-eBay permanent injunction opinions, and literally there are, by my count, 44. Some of them are simple products. Some of them are complex products. The vast majority involve claims where the products claim, but there's just one innovative element. None of them say causal nexus. None of them say even connection. But most importantly, none of them require that the latch in Bosch, the fringe effect capacitance in Presidio, they drop be the driver of consumer demand. It would be a standard that would work a fundamental change.
I understand that if you were to prove, for instance, that one of your patented features was the driver of consumer demand, then I assume that you disproved that your others are the driver of consumer demand.
That's the irony, Your Honor. If you had one patent and you could prove that it was the driver, you get an injunction. If you had six innovations, as we have here, right, that collectively revolutionized the industry but also drove the consumer purchasing decision, you would be out without an injunction.
And that's based on, though, her analysis of this aggregate.
Yes.
Let me turn you to the trade dress
issue. Sure.
Now, we're dealing with a different group of products, so I don't know, is it... they seem to be off the market, whatever the six products are or whatever. I don't know.
Your Honor, there is one design patent that we don't practice anymore as a consequence of the trade dress that we prevailed on at trial. The district court assumed that we didn't practice it. We're not contesting that. Samsung claims that it's not practicing or selling.
Well, let's assume that for purposes of my question, which is, where in your view does the law stand? We seem to have competing Ninth Circuit cases. And so do we just come out with it's a factor that can be looked at, that is, whether the infringing party continues to practice it, and we review that, obviously, under an abuse of discretion. Is that where we're left under the case law?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think where we ought to start is Section 1125, which is the provision that governs. And if you look at 1125, it doesn't say anything about the owner of the trade dress having to continue to sell products that have the trade dress. And there's a reason. If you think about the Apple products, that trade dress, right? The result
no, let's take that off the top. I'm talking about Samsung continuation.
Same answer. If you look at 1125, there is nothing in 1125 that requires that the adjudicated infringer continue to sell products with the trade dress.
No, but that's my question. Whether it's required or not, let's assume there's no black letter about the question is we're reviewing her analysis under
sure.
abuse of discretion, and so do you agree or is your reading of the case law that this is an impermissible factor to consider simply that it's a matter of weight and under an abuse of discretion standard?
Your Honor, I think there are very few factors that you couldn't consider under the broad umbrella, subject to the principles of equity. But I would say two things. In the permanent injunction analysis under the patent law, the court says no burden on Samsung because they claim not to be patenting. We get to 1125, trade dress, and she says no injunction because they're not patenting. I think if we step back from it, this is a place where whatever consideration we give ought to be driven by principles of equity and common sense. They have been determined to have infringed the trade dress. An injunction that says don't do it anymore is the correct remedy. If they truly are not doing it anymore, then they won't be burdened. There will be no further disputes. There will be no contempt proceedings. But no one will be using our trade dress. A decision that says someone can stop, and they haven't represented they'll never do it again, someone can be adjudicated a trade dress polluter. They can claim that they stop, that we will then be denied an injunction after they put the burden on the wrong party. And that's why I say we're not going to say categorically you can never consider it, but it's a factor that ought to be given very little weight. And if it's given any weight, it's probably the weight that she gave it, that Judge Koh gave it, in the permanent injunction patent law context, which is, if they're really, truly not selling it anymore, then there must not be much of a burden upon them.
Okay. I think we have your argument. We've
Thank
obviously
you.
Exceeded the time. We'll restore your rebuttal time. And since we're way beyond where we were, why don't we give you an extra 10 minutes, and we'll see where we go. Don't feel compelled to use it.
After your opening statement, can we start where we just ended so that we can get that part off the table?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. And I am returning to see you again after the preliminary injunction ruling, and I do want to say that causal nexus is the law that you've established and that the circuit has established, but I'm happy to start with trade dress first, if that's what Judge O'Malley would like.
As I understand it, the trial court relied on this Avery Dennison case for the proposition that actually says that if you're not continuing to practice, that you're therefore not entitled to an injunction. You don't seem to try to defend that in your briefs. You have other arguments, but you don't seem to try to defend that holding.
What we defend is that Apple's cessation of practicing its trade dress, the only trade dress, remember the jury only found trade dress dilution, not infringement, and only on 6 products. And Apple has discontinued using the trade dress that the jury found dilution on.
So you argue that
discontinuance
on both sides.
Discontinuance on
fair factors. But
correct,
that Avery Dennison case found that the mark wasn't even famous. I mean, it never even addressed what the trial court was saying it addressed.
Your Honor, we would urge you to affirm the denial of the injunction on the trade dress on the ground that cessation on both sides is a relevant factor. And we think their cessation is a relevant factor. Let me explain why. What trade dress protection is about is source identification. If Apple is, and remember the jury found only dilution of the now discontinued trade dress on the iPhone 3 and 3G products. So, and the trial court expressly found that there was no argument that anything that Apple's current trade dress is being diluted by anything that was proven.
So, under your theory, if Coca-Cola changes its can, that if someone infringes on the old Coke mark and dilutes the old Coke mark, Coke has no remedy?
No, it might, Your Honor, but you'd have to prove that there was a diluting effect on the currently practiced mark. And the district court found, as a matter of fact, and it's not clearly erroneous, that there was no such diluting effect proved in this case. But if I could go on.
The jury found, as a matter of fact, that there was a diluting effect.
On the trade dress employed in the now discontinued iPhone 3 products. So the jury wasn't asked to and did not find a diluting effect on the current trade dress.
Okay, so you're saying that Coke could never protect its old mark if it changed its can.
No, we're not saying that at all. We're just saying that cessation is a factor. We actually think that it's a factor. Cessation on both sides is a factor. If there was proof of diluting effect on the current dress, then that would be a relevant factor, perhaps warranting an injunction.
Well, that's a different law.
That's a different law. And I do want to get back to the point that to Judge Bryson's key point, that we're talking here about whether injunctions are going to be used based on one verdict to stop infringement or dilution against new products and new cases. And I think the answer is the injunction should not be used here. In a contempt proceeding here, especially where we're talking about design patents and trade dress, which are amorphous, should not be used as a substitute for bringing actual cases of new infringement against new products. But if I could just address the other side of the trade dress balance and answer Judge Prost's question you asked him about how to interpret Ninth Circuit law, we think there is no conflict in Ninth Circuit law. We think the Volkswagensberg case makes clear that Samsung's cessation of any trade dress dilution is a relevant factor to consider. And the Polo case is not to the contrary, it's just about burdens. So we think as a matter of Ninth Circuit law, you ought to hold
it. I'm sorry, we want to be clear on why Polo is not to the contrary.
Because Polo was just about who bears the burden of showing cessation as we read it. And so we think that it's clear that the Ninth Circuit thinks that cessation is a relevant factor, and so the district court properly took it.
Well, pretty much said it was not much of a relevant factor. Something you could consider, but it carries very little weight because if what the Polo court said was if you stopped using it, then there shouldn't be any harm to you if we tell you not to use it anymore. And if you really intend not to, then it's no big deal. And so unless you absolutely positively establish, and they cite some authority for those propositions, that you never will use it and you're not using it, then it really is not a factor. They reversed the entry of the permanent injunction on that ground.
So, Your Honor,
the permanent injunction.
Your Honor, there's other factors that justify upholding the trade dress denial of injunction, and we do want to urge you to hold as a matter of law that irreparable harm should have been considered. We think 1125, subject to the principles of equity, the language at the beginning of the statute, means all the principles of equity. That means all four eBay factors. And if you look at the irreparable harm analysis, there was no causal nexus.
Was actually amended in order to overrule the Supreme Court's decision that said you had to prove actual harm?
Yeah. But, Your Honor, in the
statute that is designed to say you don't need to show any harm require you to show irreparable harm.
Because not having to show economic injury is not the same as not having to show irreparable economic injury or non-economic injury. And the key point is that injunctions, even for trade dress, still have to be shown, in our view, to be related. The dilution in this case or infringement has to be shown to be related to the harm, and it wasn't shown here. But I think that really takes us back to causal nexus, if I could turn to that. On causal nexus, I want to respectfully disagree with my friend, Mr. Lee, that there's any ambiguity about whether causal nexus is a requirement for a patent infringement injunction in the permanent injunction context as well as the preliminary injunction context. And in answer to Judge Pro's question, what is the standard, it's already been set forth by this court. It was set forth by this court, this panel of this court, in the preliminary injunction ruling that preceded the trial in this case. And it was also set forth by a different panel of this court in the Galaxy Nexus case, the so-called Apple II case, Apple Samsung II case.
But I'm not clear. I mean, she added, did she not, the district court judge here, a gloss, which I'm not sure was apparent, at least in Apple I and Apple II, and that is this notion of aggregate, that you don't consider the patents together, even the design patents and the utility patents together.
Your Honor, interestingly, actually, the district court did not do that. I think if you look at the language, she said that Apple has failed on this record to show that any of its patented features on the design or the utility side are drivers of consumer demand. She did not hold that anyone needed to be
deep. You're saying she said it, but then she never really applied it or didn't feel the need.
The relevant sentence is she said they haven't shown that these are drivers of consumer demand.
But she specifically said that you had to prove the causal nexus on a patent-by-patent basis.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I don't think Judge Koh was faithfully applying this circuit's guidance in Apple II, which applied the causal nexus requirement on a patent-by-patent basis and was expressed in that regard. Apple II said that the infringing feature, singular, must drive the consumer demand for the accused product. So she was faithfully applying what I would submit as already circuit law on that matter. But let me be clear. We don't argue here that you're foreclosed in future cases from finding that some aggregate combination of patented features drove consumer demand. That's not proposed. It's just that here Apple utterly failed to prove either that any patented feature singly or any set of patented features taken in the aggregate was even a driver of consumer demand. And here I really need to focus the court back on what is the record in this case that could satisfy a causal nexus standard. It boils down really just to two things. One is terribly weak, almost vanishingly insignificant evidence about from consumer surveys. And what were the consumer surveys about? And you can look at these for yourself and just see why the district court was correct, that Apple didn't show that the patented features were even a driver of consumer demand, much less the driver. At A33962, you'll see an example of the so-called design matters evidence. At A33962, you'll see an example of the Apple survey evidence in which they say design matters. And if you look at that, you won't see anything about rectangular, round-cornered, flat-screen fronts of smartphones, which is all the D677 patent claims, or you won't see anything about whether a front face with a bezel on the side, which is all the D087 patent claims, or anything about whether the first page of a graphical user interface, you won't see anything about any of the patented features on page 33962. You'll just see the term design. Design matters is far too broad to show any causal nexus between any of the design patents and an effect on consumer demand. And you'll see the very same thing if you look at what is Apple's consumer evidence on the utility patent. I can tell you where it is. It's on page A32769, and a very similar example. They put in a lot of these, but the best examples are 32769 and A52037, and that's where ease of use, the term ease of use, easy to use, is listed in a set of factors that consumers say they like. Now, that has, ease of use is far too broad to encompass the narrow utility patents at issue in this case about pinch to zoom or tap to zoom. Or.
But there's
the... The portion of Apple's presentation that struck me as getting closest to the kind of specificity that you're saying was missing from the examples you've just explored was Dr. Hauser's testimony. And I'd like you to talk about why it is that you think the testimony that says that particular, that customers would pay X amount, pretty significant amounts, more for particular features, why that isn't a pretty good proxy for a demand driver. I understand it's not exactly the same thing as asking, you know, do you believe that this product would make you, this feature would make you buy that product? But it's close, isn't it? Why not?
It's not close at all, Your Honor. And the reason is all that the Hauser survey asked was, as between two Samsung products, would you pay $38 more for this feature? It's an intra-brand price premium inquiry, which doesn't correlate at all to what this court said is the relevant inquiry, which is, would you buy a Samsung phone that incorporated the infringing product over an alternative phone? It doesn't.
But isn't that telling us what the consumer thinks in the context of Samsung's phones, what the particular feature is worth?
No, Your Honor, to go back, if I could, since Mr. Lee raised it, to your cup holder example in our prior case, the fact that I'd pay $10 more to add a cup holder to a car I've already decided to buy does not tell me that the presence of the, let's assume it's an infringing cup holder, has led me to choose that car over Apple's competing car.
It's a question of then evaluating the amount. However, if it turns out that this infringing feature leads to a doubling of the price as it otherwise would have been in the absence of that infringing feature, then why isn't that at least a factor to consider in terms of causal nexus?
Because it doesn't show anything about a comparison between a product with the infringing feature and the next non-infringing alternative. The fact that the price doubles tells you only how much that feature is valued within a purchase of the product, but it doesn't show you the key factor that your test asked about, which is why pick the product with the infringing feature over the non-infringing alternative.
You're saying unless it drives the demand for the entire product, there's never going to be a right to an injunction in a multifaceted product.
Your Honor, we're saying, as I said before, it may be that some collection of features drives the product. If Apple could have shown that if you take three of these patents together and they add up to the dashboard, or three of these infringing features together and they add up to the engine, that might have been a different case.
What about if these three features add up to doubling the price of the phone?
It still doesn't tell you that the phone with the infringing feature will be chosen over the competing phone with a non-infringing alternative. It doesn't tell you that the consumer demand is driven by the infringing feature. It just tells you that the consumer values that feature.
Judge Koh's theory doesn't allow them to add up anything one with the other. She specifically said that each one has to be done on a patent-specific basis, and each one has to be the driver of consumer demand. So do you agree with me, as I asked Mr. Lee, that if you prove one of them to be the driver, you've proven yourself out of any right to injunctive relief despite the existence of a patent as to the other features?
No, we don't agree with that.
Isn't that where logically your argument takes you?
It does not. Let me go back. I want to make something clear. It is not impossible, as Apple has suggested, to design a consumer survey that will actually satisfy the causal nexus standard in a complex product. This court found, as to the D889 patent with respect to the Galaxy 10.1 tablet, you remember when we were here before, Judge Koh had found that D889 was anticipated, and you reversed on that ground and sent it back, but she had found there was a nexus between consumer demand for the Galaxy 10.1 tab and its embodiment of the infringing design feature. So it's not impossible. I mean, that was a case of a complex product. D889 didn't cover the rest of the product, the circuitry, the screen, the software, but that was a case in which the product was so the product so closely embodied the design patent. It was the entire case that was covered, unlike the D677 and the D087 here, which were much narrower. And that was a case in which causal nexus was met. So Mr. Lee is simply wrong. In this case itself proves that there's no categorical rule against finding that an infringing feature is a driver of consumer demand. But the ease of use and design matters evidence doesn't come close to showing. And the Hauser study can't show the comparative choice between the product with the infringing feature and an alternative product without the infringing feature. I might be willing to add a price premium to something I'm buying already within the brand, but it doesn't tell me that that's the reason why I've chosen the product. Now,
I think an economist would have difficulty with that assertion, the one that you just made, because it seems to me that there's not very much difference between saying that, let's change the cup holders to a hybrid engine. If you have a car with a hybrid engine in it, you say, okay, how much is that hybrid engine worth to the consumer? Well, it's probably worth an extra $5,000 for people that end up with the hybrid engine version. That's roughly what it costs. Now, if you say you can't have the hybrid engine, I may still buy the car without the hybrid engine if it's $6,000 cheaper, but that certainly is a demand-related feature, right? Because many people will pay $5,000, and if they can get it for only $4,000 more, they'll grab it. That seems to me in the essence of what driver of demand really is. That's what I'm having difficulty with your saying, well, Hauser is really irrelevant to the inquiry here.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not saying, we do think Hauser is irrelevant to the inquiry you set forth. So you would be making new law to say that this kind of evidence is probative of consumer demand. You've previously suggested in the prior cases that you have to show that the product is the driver of consumer demand for the product with the infringing feature as compared with an alternative product, not whether it's an element of consumer demand within the product that you're looking at. And all Hauser asks is, would you pay more for a Samsung phone if it has this product? Now, by the way, we haven't talked about adequacy of monetary compensation. If anything, the Hauser survey shows our point that Judge Koh properly found on, that Apple is fully capable of being achieving a remedy here through monetary compensation. If these features are monetizable, as the Hauser survey suggests, it just confirms that point. But the real point that hasn't been mentioned yet, and I want to put it before you, is that Apple licensed all of its utility patents and licensed its unique user experience IP, which contains its trade dress.
Actually, I was going to take you to that. That's the next point. So I'm glad you raised it, which is her analysis, and she obviously was briefer here than in her other opinions, and we're grateful for that. But her analysis on the license issue seems to kind of ignore what I think is perhaps an important component. She doesn't talk about the relationship that is. She cites IBM, HTC. She doesn't talk about the relationship between the parties, the licensing parties, in that and how that compares to Apple, Samsung. She also makes reference to the fact that reference to the Apple-Samsung relationship is that Apple offered to license some of its patents, but Mr. Lee says, and I don't think it's beyond dispute, that those were patents other than the ones at issue in this case. Aren't those factors at least relevant, and shouldn't she have at least addressed those before placing so much weight on the licensing issue?
First, we think not. We think that the inquiry under adequacy of monetary compensation, it does not require a question about whether monetary compensation is sufficient as between the parties. What you have done as recently as the Active Video case is found that licensing, including licensing to non-competitors, is probative of the ability of money to satisfy the remedy for the infringement. So we think it would be too demanding for you to say that she wasn't entitled to look at those licenses unless she proved that they were comparable.
But did she look at them, or did she make it determinative? I mean, she said that Apple had to prove that its patented features were completely priceless.
No, 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 Your Honor, we strenuously disagree.
She said that more than once, though.
No, Your Honor, what she was doing, what Apple was making a claim that is belied by the record, that it didn't want to license its patents. That's wrong, and I want to focus, if I could, there's two very important pages in the record that I do want Your Honors to look at. One is page A21957.
Do you know which volume that has?
21957.
Three.
In volume three. If you look on that page, you'll see that Apple's own licensing executive, Mr. Texler, admits that Apple had licensed its unique user experience IP. And he explains in the surrounding pages that unique user experience IP includes all of the designs in this case. So I want to first just make, the record is clear that every patent here was licensed. The utility patents were licensed to Nokia, IBM, and HTC. The design patents were licensed by Apple's own admission. And the other page I really want you to focus on, if I could, Your Honors, is page A33916. Which volume is that? 33916. This is a... This is
volume four.
Volume four. And I'm sorry to make you flip through all the volumes, Your Honor, but it's important because I think I want to be clear to you how strong the licensing record is here. And this also distinguishes some of your other post-eBay decisions where there was not a licensing history. We're not going to end injunctions in this case for cases where there isn't a licensing history, but here there is one. And here, Judge Prost is the most salient one, the offer to license to Samsung itself. On page A33916, you see the beginning, the crucial page in a long PowerPoint presentation that's all in the record. Here's an October 5th, 2010 offer by Apple to license these products to Samsung itself. So we're not just relying on the licensing history with HTC and Nokia, which are competitors,
but they weren't for the same patented features, were they? They weren't licensing those patents.
Actually, they were, Your Honor. If I could, on page 33916, you'll see Samsung chose, Apple would have preferred that Samsung request a license in advance. We are prepared to offer a royalty-bearing license for this category of device. And if you want to see Apple's admission that this category of device includes the patented features, Judge O'Malley, just look at Mr. Texler's admission on page A21972, which is where Mr. Texler at trial says, license we offered to Samsung included our industrial design, and industrial design includes the design features. So, Your Honor, it was an offer to license the product, and it included all of the patents at stake in this case. So, Judge Prost, if there's anything missing on the Apple-Samsung comparison, I respectfully submit that this part of the record satisfies it, although I don't think you need to go so far.
Mr. Texler, a few pages later, specifically denies that this presentation encompasses what he refers to as the user experience patents. And that's at 22013.
Correct, Your Honor. He walks it back there, but we just think it's belied by the documentary evidence. And
but
so the
never,
district court was
the
entitled
district court
to.
Never made a finding on that. I mean, that seems to me a significant and sharply contested issue, but there's no finding. So we can't really conclude, I wouldn't think, that this page trumps Mr. Texler's denial of exactly the same point, can we?
Well, no. I think that if you look at the documentary evidence, if you have any doubt about that, you could remand on this issue. But there would be little point to it because the other licensing history is sufficient even without this specific licensing history. I'm just trying to answer Judge Prost's question about whether an Apple-Samsung comparison was made. I would submit that, in fact, the licensing history to others shows the adequacy of monetary compensation. And let's recall here that the point about the injunction is the injunction is really going to, and I want to talk about balance of hardships and public interest if I could for a moment. The sole real purpose of the injunction here, since, as Judge Bryson observed, Samsung has ceased to make, we've discontinued all but three of the products, and it's undisputed that there's been a design around as to the features of the continuing products that were found to infringe. So there is no more. There is no Samsung is not practicing or embodying any of the features that are protected by Apple's patents. So what Mr. Lee is asking you to do is essentially impose upon the district court, who faithfully followed your rulings, a requirement that she enter an injunction the true purpose of which is really going to be to avoid Apple's need to come forward in future cases and prove infringement. We've already seen with the TAB 10.1 patent that an injunction...
So they would have to prove infringement even if there is a contempt proceeding.
Your Honor, that's what the law requires, but you'll see that the injunction that Apple sought, the very overbroad injunction that Apple sought...
Well, no more than colorably different.
No more than colorably different, but
that's,
they don't...
That's standard language. In fact, it's implied within any injunction against a product.
Well, Judge Koh correctly found that in this setting... You would be taking complex products away from the public. You would be imposing hardships on carriers and retailers.
If you're selling design around and there's lots of other products available, why are you taking anything away from the public?
Because, Your Honor, the carriers and retailers, as we saw in the TAB 10.1 injunction context after it went back on remand and Judge Koh issued the preliminary injunction on the TAB 10.1, we saw that the real harm was to carriers and retailers who were confused about what possible liability they would have for keeping inventory.
What evidence in the record did you present that carriers and retailers would be harmed if this injunction was issued?
Well, the 10.1 we think is probative of
affidavits from carriers and retailers?
We did. We submitted evidence from the carriers, which is referenced in the record in page 51441. That's a reference to a brief, Your Honor, but it refers to the record in the Apple One preliminary injunction record, so you can look at the materials submitted in that record. But I really...
And you're telling me there's affidavits from retailers and suppliers in that record?
Not affidavits, Your Honor. Not affidavits.
Okay.
But I'd like to return to what I think is the central point before you, which is Mr. Lee has come before you, if I may just have a few extra minutes, Your Honor.
Yes.
Mr. Lee has come before you and said that we've argued for a categorical rule against injunctions in complex product cases. That is not correct. And I want to point out how narrow the case before you is. It's what we think is a garden variety, absolutely methodical application of the four eBay factors to this case. And here's what's not at stake at this case. And I think his suggestion that injunctions are going to be, you know, we're going to cause the death of injunctions in complex product cases, that's greatly exaggerated. And here's why. First, this case is just about lost sales and lost market share and lost downstream sales. And I really need to correct something that Mr. Lee, my good friend Mr. Lee, said earlier. He said twice that Judge Koh found that Samsung's infringement caused irreparable harm. She didn't find that. We wouldn't be here if she had. What she found is that Apple had suffered lost sales, but what she found was missing was the causal nexus between infringement and lost sales or lost market share or lost downstream sales. So first, nothing in this case affects other kinds of harm. You may still issue injunctions or require issuance of injunctions in cases where the harm is something other than lost sales, lost market share. Eye for eye, if somebody's destroyed your business line by bundling an infringing feature with a product, destruction of a business line, you're not going to reach this causal nexus question. The second point is we're not arguing for a categorical rule. There may be other cases where complex products don't have any licensing history, or where the defendant can't pay. In Bosch against Pylon, one of the concerns you cited in sending the case back was that Pylon was a judgment-proof defendant. So we're not ending injunctions in the classic case where monetary compensation can't suffice, and there is no licensing history, and the defendant can't pay. The third thing is we're certainly not suggesting that you can't uphold injunctions or send the case back to enter an injunction in a case where the patent is virtually coextensive with the product, something that might come up often, for example, in the pharma context, or that might come up in the context, as we argued, of a very simple device like an orthopedic nail or a snowplow latch lever or a windshield wiper blade, even if there were two patents on it. The chances, the more the patent is coextensive with the product, the less likely there is to be any causal nexus limitation on an injunction because selling the product will be affected by infringing the patent. This is not that case. But even in a case where there's thousands of features embodied in an accused product, We're not eliminating injunctions, Your Honor. We're just saying Apple should have been held to its proof. And Apple didn't satisfy the proof here. And if I could just address one last... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Quickly, briefly.
Very briefly, Your Honor. Thank you for indulging me with extra time. I must strenuously disagree with Mr. Lee when he said that there's additional evidence here justifying an injunction based on Samsung's so-called copying. There was no jury finding of copying. We strenuously disagree with the point that there was copying. We've given to you on pages 33 and 34 of the red brief evidence that was not before the jury. It was excluded based on a discovery ruling, but it was before the court in the post-trial proceedings, and obviously the concern about confusion to the jury was not present before the court. So we didn't copy, but even if we had, I'd just like to remind the court that Mr. Lee can't use copying as evidence to favor of injunction because this court has twice said that copying is irrelevant to consumers' perception. You said it in Apple One and Apple Two.
I don't recall that we said that it was irrelevant. It seems to me that we said that it was not dispositive.
Your Honor, what you said in, if I may,
sure.
Apple One, I like these passages very much, if I could just read them back to you, Your Honor. The relevant inquiry, this is Apple One, this panel, focuses on the objective reasons as to why the patentee lost sales, not on the infringer's subjective belief as to why it gained them or would be likely to gain them. I think, Judge Bryson, you said engineers get interested in a lot of things that consumers don't.
Right, but I think just before that passage, I think we may have said something like, of course, evidence of copying is definitely relevant. Isn't it? That was my recollection. But you have the paper in front of you, and I don't, so you have me at a disadvantage. There.
Relevant but not dispositive is what you said. But
no, that was my point.
But, Your Honor, in Apple II, if I could just remind you.
I think we have the case. We can debate. We can all look at the cases.
But Your Honor, we're not asking for a categorical end to injunctions. Please look at the record here and how there was no proof of any infringement here being a driver of consumer demand, much less the driver. And if Apple lost market share, the whole point of causal nexus is to distinguish between Apple losing market share based on Samsung's infringement and Samsung's legitimate competition. Thank you.
We thank you. Okay. So now in an effort to try to keep it as even as we can, by my count, I think we'll give you 7 minutes of rebuttal.
I'll try to do it more quickly. Let me address 3 points broadly. First, on the licensing, there is nothing in the record that design patents that were found to be infringed were licensed to anyone. There is nothing in the record that the trade dress that was found to be diluted was licensed to anyone. The only reference to the design experience having been licensed is a pre-2002 cross-license with Microsoft. That was 5 years before the iPhone came to market. We're talking about a different set of design patents.
What about the document that Ms. Sullivan referred us to?
What Ms. Sullivan gave you was a page from the presentation that Apple made in an effort to prevent this litigation from ever occurring. And if you look at the page, you will see that there's no specific reference to these design patents, to the trade dress, to the utility patents. And Mr. Texer was asked specifically, did you offer to license Samsung any of the asserted patents or trade dress? And the answer was unequivocally no. So there was, are there other licenses and other patents? And Judge Kowadesi, careful, she said, there are licenses of some patents that there were. There's no evidence that these design patents were licensed or that the trade dress was licensed.
But the utility patents have been licensed to HTC, Nokia, and IBM, right? And I understand your argument with respect to IBM, they don't make phones. Your argument with respect to HTC is that this was a settlement of litigation, but Nokia.
Your Honor, two things. Nokia is a settlement of litigation.
Oh, was it also a settlement
yes.
of litigation? Okay, but two of the utility patents. Well, I guess that raises the question of why does it matter that it's a settlement of litigation? I mean, there doesn't seem to be any law for the proposition that you asserted in your brief that that makes a big difference.
Your Honor, I think, I don't know if the court's addressed it specifically, right. But it should make a difference because
you don't want to discourage settlement of litigation. I understand that.
That's exactly right. If I could add two factors on these licenses, because I do think this standard of priceless or off-limits is the standard that she articulated. But in the HTC license agreement, and this is the importance of getting into the details, judged against the standard, there was an anti-cloning provision.
Right. Right. But not in the Nokia license,
right.
I gather.
The Nokia wasn't even really a license. It's a standstill provision, Your Honor, where during that period of time, you don't sue each other, but damages accrue. It's not a license. Damages are still accruing. When the standstill period is over, you can sue, and you can collect damages for that period of time. You're just not going to sue each other.
Oh, that was not a license?
The overall thing is called a cross-license, right. But when you get to the part that we're talking about with utility patents, it's called a standstill.
Okay.
And so that's the reason. I think if you look at this question of adequacy of monetary damages, no evidence of licensing the design patents, no evidence of licensing the trade dress. The three utility patents have been licensed twice in litigation and once to a non-competitor. Second point is this. We're not saying, in answer to Joe Mellon's question, that there doesn't have to be some connection between the patented feature, the adjudicated infringement, and the irreparable harm. In this case, the judge co-found that the sales of the infringing products did cause lost downstream sales, lost market share. We are saying that to the extent there needs to be a connection, that should be enough. And that is the way that I think you can reconcile all of this court's 44-some decisions that have addressed this issue. Apple I and Apple II were in a preliminary injunction context. I've tried to identify the differences, but we've had this evolution from some causation, which is in Apple I, to a driver to the driver. And that evolution takes us to a point where it is a categorical exclusion of a whole set of products that you would not get an injunction for. And even if it has to be a driver, at pages 84514 to 8519, there is the information from Professor Hauser. And the title at 84515 is Demand is Driven by Features Associated with Infringed Patents. I mean, he's addressing this issue specifically.
Well, but the argument that Ms. Sullivan is making is that, well, that's what he says he's addressing, but his survey evidence does not make that point. Could you briefly address
Your Honor, if someone is going to pay a price premium for a product, and that feature is in the product, that's an indication that it is at least a driver of consumer demand. Could I...
If it's a large enough price to I mean, if it's I'll pay an extra 5 cents for the cup holder, you might conclude that's not driving demand in any material way.
I think that's correct.
But $5,000 for a hybrid engine may be a different story.
Yeah, and I actually bet that folks with families would pay an extra $300 for the cup holders in their car. So if it's enough, right, if it's enough...
Well, I wouldn't. Maybe it's because I can't afford it.
Yeah, I have grandchildren now, so I would. Last point is this. As we read Apple I on this issue of copying, what the court said is the subjective mind of the Samsung engineers may not tell you what the consumers are thinking. We're not focused on the subjective mind. We're focused on what they did. They copied the features. You have in the record for you Exhibit 44 from the trial. It was a 145-page document, and on the left of one of every page, on the left was the iPhone, on the right was their phone, and at the bottom was a recommendation. And for a host of features, including features here, the recommendation was copy. The fact of copying, as opposed to the subjective mind, is relevant. It does demonstrate what's important to consumers. In fact, the fact that our primary competitor copied and felt it needed to copy and to put down in writing that it was copying is probably the best indication these features are important.
What do you say about Ms. Sullivan's reference to the, I don't have it in view for me, I think that, yes, here it is, page 33, the Samsung of her brief, the red brief, the Samsung phones during the evolution.
Yeah, but there are two things, Your Honor. Ms. Sullivan was correctly characterized it. It was excluded as a sanction for discovery abuse. That's why it was excluded from
at trial.
At trial.
But it was before the court, was it not, for the purpose of the injunction?
It was before the court without any explanation of what the phones were, what they did, when they came into the market. It was just there. And there was not to consider, and you'll note the court did not consider. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both counsel and the case is submitted. That concludes our proceedings for this morning.
All right.